The following is Hillary Marsh's talk, Managing the Politics of Content, from the 2015 Information Architecture Summit.
Good morning. So I'm going to do my own introduction. It's early. It's Saturday morning. Everyone's having coffee. This is the room of people who have organizational challenges that prevent our web efforts from being successful. Am I right? So how many people here work for a university? Or with universities at an agency? How many people work for an association or a nonprofit organization? Good. So my name's Hillary Marsh. I'm a content strategy consultant, and I've also served as the website director for the National Association of Realtors. And most of my clients are associations and nonprofits. And so this is the stuff that I deal with every day and that you all deal with every day. And I'm really glad that you're here. So let's just get started. There's so many things to talk about. So when other people hear politics, they might think this. In our world, it's something a little bit closer to this, that the people having the Rock'em Sock'em robot conversations are marketing or different product lines, or usually it's this, that it's everyone else and there's us, the web team. So according to our peers, our bosses, our spouses, our friends, okay, so you manage a website, how hard could it be, right? We do a wireframe and it looks like this. And IT thinks, oh, how hard is it? We'll just put the last three articles on the homepage, done deal. Or if people can't find things, we'll just delete everything on the site that's older than a year. How often have we heard that one? So here's some of what politics looks like, at least in my experience. So this is Jamie. Jamie's the social media manager of the organization, and she started a month ago. So she comes to the web director, and she says, okay, we want to have social media channels, and we don't have them today. This is my job. So I want to create a YouTube channel. I want to create Google Plus. I want a Facebook page or several, or LinkedIn or Instagram and StumbleUpon, etc., etc., etc. And all of those, each of these is going to need its own content stream because it'll just happen. I don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but all of these are so, so, so important to our organization because without this, we're not going to succeed. And this is Terrence. Terrence is in charge of a program, and let's pretend for this very second that we're the Department of Education, and Terrence is in charge of the Teacher of the Year program. So Terrence already worked with IT to put it on the homepage, right there, center, because it's the most important thing that the organization is doing. And the only reason he's coming to you, the web director, is that he wants it in the newsletter. And this is Jeremy. Jeremy is the assistant director in charge of meetings, and Jeremy is up on the newest, latest of everything. So Jeremy has this great idea for what he wants to do on the meetings homepage, and he wants there to be a person walking across the bottom of the screen and telling everybody, hi. So a little funny aside about this, this technology doesn't exist anymore, thank God. But this is actually a live page on the Disney Channel's media site so that you can actually still see a rendition of what this looked like, which is just unbelievable that it's there from 2006, live on the web. And this is Martha. Martha's the senior deputy to the president. And she wants to make sure that the president's speech is up on the website as soon as possible because it's so, so, so important. So, you know, you work with her to put the president's speech online along with all the others that are really, really old. And you know how many people visited each of these? 15. Total. Yeah, total. So when I was at NAR, that was the course of my typical week. And so this was my first reaction. Like, oh my gosh, crazy. My second reaction was sort of this. And the more I thought about requests like this and the endless stream of ones just like this that would come to me in the course of a day. The madder and madder I got. So it came time finally to do a redesign of our homepage, at least. We couldn't redesign the whole site, but at least we wanted to redesign the homepage to make progress toward a new and better structure for the site. So I went to talk to my boss. That's not my boss, but good rendition of boss-like figure. And I said to him, okay, so we have too much, and it's just crazy, all the randomness that comes across my desk. And so we worked with a user experience consultant, and he kind of said, you have a fork in the road. There are two different approaches you can take. One approach is a very tightly curated approach, where you make serious prioritization choices about what goes on the homepage. The second approach is that you give everyone enough of a vehicle and a spot on the homepage to represent themselves correctly. This was, at the time, what we ended up with. And it's not that unattractive, I don't think. And this, of course, rotated, because it is what it is. We couldn't do away with the organizational focus left nav because we used Lotus Notes, or Domino, and the design was baked right into the presentation on several of our databases. But that's not all. This is what the homepage actually looked like. So clearly, we had to choose option B. Everyone had a little slot, or an accordion, or a button, or an area, every initiative, every program, everything. And how many people scroll to the bottom to the in case you missed the very important stuff that was on the homepage last week? Not that many. So I have some quotes peppered throughout here. Then there's my other favorite one, which I didn't include, called shouldihaveacarousel.com, which is absolutely hysterical. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it, and go show it to everybody when you get home. So I wanted to talk for a minute about the word content. So I know that many people in this room are not content strategists, but we all work with content. And content's a terrible word. No one goes to school to be a content creator. We call what they do content, but they do not. And that's really important because we have to do our own translation as well, and we should. So content instead is everything that they do. It's the events and the products and the classes, programs, research, etc. So if all of that is content, content strategy, because content is the way that all of these things are manifested in the world, not only on a website, not only digitally, but in the world, it all shows up as content. So content strategy is really an event strategy, a program strategy, class strategy. It's a strategy for each of the things that this is. And this is why it's political, right? Because who's in charge of the event strategy? You, the web director? Yeah, I don't think so. You, the UX person? You, the content strategist? I don't think so. But we're actually responsible for it together. And it's got to be a partnership that you're an expert in what you do, and I'm an expert in helping it go online so that people can find it and use it. And it takes two. It takes that partnership in order to make it work. So, and that's why content is political, because nobody ever had that conversation before. And they think that they're in charge of the whole thing, soup to nuts. They're in charge of whether their page has tabs and whether it's blue blinking text or all of that stuff. And they think that that's part of the event strategy as opposed to the web component to it. So if content is all these things, where it gets tricky is that that's how people think of it. My event, my product, etc. And it looks a little like this. I love that picture. Another quote, every pixel has an owner. So think about that homepage for realtor.org where every pixel literally had an owner. And yet what that didn't do is ultimately what helps and what makes that difference, which is to build the bridges between the content areas and show that it's not one at a time, and we'll talk about this in a second, but that it's a collective effort and a collective presence. And what each person works on is a really important piece, and what's extra important is the whole of the pieces collected together. So here's a quote from 1935 from Upton Sinclair, writer and organizational guy. It's hard to get somebody to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. And I think that that sums up what we do best of all. And personally, I think that politics are caused by budgeting process. So if I'm budgeted to get my program done this year and to get it promoted this year, that's it. I'm a person with a mission. I don't really care about anybody else's program or anybody else's product or class, because that's not in my interest. Because when things are budgeted alone, the success looks like it's in a vacuum. And so ultimately, our changes have to be higher than us, that we're not empowered to enact the change that we need to happen. We can shine a light on the fact that it needs to happen, and we'll talk about that more later, but we can't make it happen by ourselves. And I think that another reason is this. Things are as they are because we've always done it that way. And this is actually the title of a great little book about associations, but you hardly even need to read the book because the title sort of says it all. And I don't know about you, but when I started at my organization, I heard this phrase all the time, practically once a week. This is like this because we've always done it that way. So this is how I can't draw to save my life, so this is a little better than I normally do. But back before the internet existed, none of this was an issue. Every department, every group had its own message and its own audience, and they handed it to people in person, or they mailed them a newsletter, or they gave them a brochure. And so it didn't matter whether things agreed. It didn't matter whether they're describing our organization in a common way so that it does or doesn't even sound like the same organization. And so this is the mindset of people who have worked there a long time, or who lived in the world, in the business world, before the internet played the role it was today. I worked for a long time before the internet existed. And websites at first were just sort of this cool little thing off to the side, and then it didn't matter. Then it didn't affect people's work. And then somebody had the bright idea, oh my God, if we put our stuff online, it's free. So then they started using it to save money and save time. But all of a sudden, the person who used to be in charge of managing that agency to design the brochure, and again, it didn't matter whether it matched, really matched, or kind of sort of matched the organizational standards or any of that, now all of a sudden, it all lives next to each other on the homepage. And whether it gets its own box or has to share a box or make cross-linking, all of a sudden, it's an issue. Now we have responsive and automatically generated related links, and so now this stuff really is integrated with each other, and when you click on a page and it's like, surprise, brand new experience, then it just doesn't feel like a holistic experience, and it isn't, in fact, a holistic experience. And the whole, like, we're special, I'm more special, so I need my own experience, and that navigation's not going to work for me thing, really gets to be a jarring experience for the user. So instead, the new thinking has to look something like this, and again, I'm not paid to do visuals for a living, and it's a really good thing, which is that we're an entity with a whole collection of programs and offerings, and from all of those emerges a collection of messages, and the audience then has the opportunity, not even obligation, but the opportunity to discover for themselves what that whole looks like. Because from the nucleus of having the idea, there often is not a very clear trajectory, if that's a word, for remembering why we have this, why we do this collection of stuff. And so if you're just looking at tunnel vision, then you're not creating the opportunity for the audience to cross-discover what else there is. It's usually a common audience and a common set of reasons for having this myriad group of programs or products or offerings or whatever, but we forget to make the connection. And that's where politics gets in the way of a website working. So content strategy is change management, in my mind. And more than that, user experience is change management, And digital is change management because it's shining a light on the organization in a much more holistic way than could have happened before the internet existed. So here's what doesn't work. When I started at NAR, I spent my first 6 months there creating our content strategy. And it was a big book that listed everything. Here's what should be a PDF, and here's what should not be a PDF, and why. Here's who should get a blog, and here's who shouldn't, and why. Here's what an online poll would look like, and here's how it would work. Here's what goes on the homepage, and here's what doesn't, and why. And we spent a long time and a lot of time thinking about our technology strategy, our content strategy, user experience, accessibility guidelines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was, like I said, a big book. And we had 23 departments in the organization that created content. Some were in Chicago, some were in DC, and we made time with the heads of every department to walk them through, here are the high points, and here's your book. It was a big physical binder filled with all this stuff. And here's how the site's gonna work right now, and here's like the high points you have to know, and we did this 23 times. Flew ourselves to DC to have the meetings with the DC people. And guess what happened after each of the meetings? What did the people do with the book? Stuck it on the shelf, exactly. So really, who is the audience for this? It was us. Because they weren't gonna change a single thing about how they did things. They might kinda sorta remember why we were gonna say no if they wanted that 80-page thing that they had been working on for 8 months and created as a fancy-looking PDF. If we said no, we're not gonna stick it up on the website that way. And in fact, it was still hard for us to say no because they promised, they were emailing it Monday to their committee and they needed to send them a link. So it had to be up there. So, okay, so we can say no, yes this time, but just know in advance that we're gonna say no next time. And next time came around and it wasn't a whole lot different. So that doesn't work. What also doesn't work is this. That didn't get me too far. So I went to talk to a whole bunch of people to ask, well, what does work? What has worked for you? This is Amanda Costello, who lives here in Minneapolis and in fact was at the happy hour last night that I went to. Amanda works in the Department of Education or the School of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. So Amanda is both the content strategist and the project manager within her college. There are 8 programs, and she very proudly says that each of the 8 has their own content strategist, which she feels really, really proud of. And so Amanda said, I can't mandate everything because everyone wants to do what they want to do. And instead, our content strategy has to support the groups as they envision it. So we have to empower them. And so she looks for opportunities to teach and show best practices. And here's one of the things she said. What she has is a situation that we all have, which is that she's got a list of all the things that they're going to be working on in the next quarter. And then leadership comes in and says, well, guess what? My thing has to come first. Everybody else is going to get bumped. Right? We've all been there. So this is what she does. She at least understands that you need to be transparent so that if your project gets bumped, let people know why so that it's not just a surprise or it doesn't look like you're sticking your heels in or for some reason saying no, but instead show them what they can be doing while they start, whether that's reviewing their pages and seeing if there's things that can be updated or deleted now or whether they're gonna start writing the content now or whatever it is that they can be doing now. This is Matthew Grocki. Matthew did a project for a big computer technology firm, and this company wanted to raise customer satisfaction. The other pocket of clients that I work with are intranets, in particular, corporate intranets, which are similar. The politics are exactly the same, and I think that it's because the relationship between an association and its members is pretty much exactly the same as the one between a big corporation and its employees. Sort of us, sort of understand, sort of the same assumptions about understanding that aren't actually true. But anyway, so he did something similar. So this company wanted to increase customer satisfaction and reduce phone calls to the help center by having better support content. So some content was created by the tech folks. Some content was created by the marketing people, total silo. So what he did was he called all 50 to 60 people and had workshops. And the workshop's intention was to ask them what was going to work. So he established himself as a listener. And then he recommended that they have a cross-functional editorial team headed by an editor-in-chief who was agnostic. And he had a great quote that said, you know, lines of business are really effective for profit, but not so good for content or for efficiency. He said that the best thing you can do is be an evangelist for the good work that the people are doing and help them understand that you're their champion and you're making way for them to do what they do best. So this is how you establish yourself as a partner as opposed to an enemy, which I thought was also really, really good advice. So this is Sarah Zielskis-Walsh, who used to work with me at the National Association of Realtors, and Sarah is now the lead content strategist for Motorola.com. So Motorola, giant company, same kind of politics that we encounter all the time. And Sarah said that one of the things that she does is rather than just show her ideas sort of in the dark and without any advanced preparation, she sort of shops them in advance. She does this thing called the pre-sell, which is that she calls someone into the room and says, hi, can I show you something? And what that does is that it invites them in. It makes them feel really special because they've gotten a sneak peek of what her idea is. And if they have input, they have an opportunity to give it to her in advance and she can hear it one-on-one. And then when it comes time to do sort of the bigger reveal, she's already pre-sold it, so it's pretty much not in danger of getting knocked down. And so I thought that that was also really, really good advice. This is Mary and Claire, who work at a university in Australia. I can't remember the name of it, and they asked me not to say. And I had a great Skype conversation with them last week, and they said, our university is pretty much run by fiefdom. And they have just gone through the first wave of a redesign. They reduced the number of web pages they had from 10,000 to 1,000 pages. They trained all the content contributors in a new structured content way. And they did a really good thing, which is that they built content ownership into everybody's job description, which was great. And they said once they laid all these good foundational pieces in place, they thought their job was going to be to monitor a group of empowered authors, which perfect, right? But that's not really the reality. Their reality is that they find that because once the training is done, that people have a lot of power to do whatever they want, and so that they do whatever they want. So here's their quote, that what they do instead, because there is no lockdown, so instead it's about the relationships that they build with the individual content owners. And another quote that I thought was really, really important, remember everyone is trying to do a good job, but they don't always have the resources or skills they need. So we need to have empathy for the people we work with, because just like they have to understand that we're not saying no just because we feel like it, they're not doing what it is that we think is best practice because they don't feel like it. They have other things going on. They have pressure from their leadership. They don't have time to do it the way we're asking. They don't have time to build a whole separate, or work with us to build a whole separate section on the website for that 80-page PDF. It's already a done deal. They can't go back and undo it at this point. Maybe they can do it differently next time, hopefully. But, you know, we have to have empathy for them as well. And this is Carrie, who's sitting right there. There she is. And Carrie has a great quote as a fellow website director for an association that says, use strategic nagging, which is a phrase that I love really so much, which is, keep repeating the same message over and over and over again. And that idea of operationalizing what you do actually is more familiar than you think. We haven't done it, but the world does it all the time. How many red lights are there? They're not each a surprise. You know this is the pattern and this is the way it works. So repeating the same message over and over again at the right time is such a good technique because they will remember. And I think that they're sort of the marketing mindset, which is that you have to repeat the same message several times. And there's the communication mindset, which is, I told you last week, or I told you 8 months ago, what do you mean you forgot? So we in life are surrounded by repetitive messages, and it's okay and important to repeat yourself. Anything else that I should add about that? Good. Just checking. So here's some of the things that have worked for me. So I have lots of pictures instead of the words that I just use innately. So at NAR, one of the things that I did that worked really well to get us working together instead of in opposition to each other was something called empathy-based personas. And the empathy-based personas are created by the organization. So we had people in a room thinking about and putting ourselves in the shoes of our audience and our members. And that was really important because everyone started the conversation going, yeah, but my members, yeah, but my committee, yeah, but the people I tend to work with think this way. Well, so check your job title at the door and let's think together, who are these people? What keeps them awake at night? What are their motivations and their fears and their opportunities so that you're thinking from their perspective, which is brand new for most of these folks. And this particular technique is now something that I build into every content strategy proposal that I create. I don't do it. I don't lead it. I work with somebody who does this for a living. And he is so good at getting people to step outside their own skin and their own job title and put themselves in the shoes of the audience. This is who we came up with. And these personas were actually quite amazing, I think. We did these in 2009, and I can still tell you great amounts of detail about each of these people. And the one on the left is every association's future member. And we actually didn't like this guy by the time we invented him because he's a very slick salesperson. The organization doesn't really know how to talk to him, doesn't understand, doesn't have experience, and he wants information right now. He wants it in a completely different way than the members we were used to serving. And understanding what made him tick and how we could get through to him was incredibly informative. So when we were done with this exercise, we made life-size cutouts, and we actually introduced them to the staff. And it really was incredibly helpful. Another thing we did when it came time to apply some of the same thinking to our e-newsletter challenge, we had a huge e-newsletter challenge. Everyone and their brother had an e-newsletter coming from the organization. And we found, of course, that the more we sent, the less they opened. And so even though each particular one cost like 0.06 of a cent, it added up over time because our volume was just so incredibly high. So in that case, what we did was we had a communication summit, a two-day communication summit. And again, it cost the organization a lot because they flew people from some of the 23 departments creating content into Chicago for 2 days and took them offline from their regular work. And we had them send examples of their web content and their e-newsletters and anything else that they were producing and bring them with them. It took us an entire day to go through everybody's content. And we called it the recitation. And then the second day, they broke up into teams, again, agnostic about what department they were working with, and worked on solutions. So what are we going to do about this? What we ended up doing was returning back to a structure where everyone's content fed into a single weekly e-newsletter with, I think, one exception. And I don't remember what the actual number of e-newsletters what we had before then was, but it was a huge shift to go back to a single one. And then we set up a structure where they could submit things and recommend what weeks it would go in, and there was a curated section at the top that came in like the voice of the president, whatever. And that really helped a lot. The shared experience and the shared solution is the best way I know, or one of the best ways to get buy-in. So here's some others, which is don't just tell people your content is not working, show them. So this is something called the customer focus calculator. It used to be called the we calculator because it measured the balance between how much we're talking about us and how much we're talking about you. And this particular example was AT&T, and so theirs is about 60-40. When I did this recently for a business-to-business client, they got zero. It was all about them, nothing about the customer. So that's customerfocuscalculator.com. We also analyzed at a different time the items we had in one of our newsletters to look at what's working and what's not working. And what we found is that the most popular items were externally focused. They were audience focused, they were useful to them, they were relevant and timely. The least read items, so again, this is out of qualitative into quantitative, were those about us. No one cares. They're not in this. There's a saying, your customers don't care about your products and your services, they just care about themselves. And this is, again, how we get out of politics, and we have to figure out how not to put the Teacher of the Year as the centerpiece on the homepage, or the fact that we have a new president. That doesn't matter. Have the president doing something that is relevant to them and just put their face in there for a reason, but don't just have that item because it's taking up valuable space away from information that is really relevant to them. And I recommend getting your governance in order. So this is from the Stanford Social Innovation Review, and this is a wonderful series of articles on the four ways to manage digital projects for nonprofits. And we can talk about only this for hours and hours because it's fascinating, but these are different models about how web teams are run within the context of bigger organizations. And I'll just tell you, everybody picks hybrid. They always pick hybrid everything. But there's totally centralized, totally decentralized, sort of a pave the way, go do what you want. And then there's the hybrid, which is the combination, and everybody always picks that, the combination of a central body to set policies and then representatives who are accountable in each of the areas. And so this works really well in organizations like the ones we work with, like universities, nonprofits, associations, government. And there's the lovely RACI chart. Anyone here not familiar with RACI? It's responsible, accountable, consulted, yeah. So I recommend this as well. So a couple of other ideas, which is to do pilot projects. Start small and find willing volunteers, the people who've been begging you to do something really cool and different, well, let them try it. Just say yes and work with them so that it's the best yes it can be and see how it works. And if it works, go share those successes. And if it doesn't work, that's okay. This is how we learn to walk. We try, we fall. We try, we fall. We try, we fall. We try, we get up. It's just how it has to happen. And then at some point, you're going to have the conversation with the CEO to say, things are not okay, here's the changes we have to make. So this is the agenda for your meeting with the CEO. So it's gonna require you to set it up in advance and for you to get the buy-in at levels closer to you beforehand, but show what's broken and why. Show the potential about what could be better if we did it better, and you have evidence to show it. You have the pilot projects that have worked, and you can say, here's what didn't work, here's, we tried this other thing, it didn't work, but we tried this and it worked. So I have the policies in place, I have the structure in place, I know what works look like, and here's how we have to change the governance structure, change the reporting structure. The university people from Australia, they really have a plan to make all the people in those disparate groups have a line, a dotted line reporting to them so that it's not just a nice to have, it's built in. And anticipate the roadblocks that the CEO is going to raise. What about my leadership when they want to do this? And you have to think about how you're going to accommodate that as well. And then follow up and talk to the person right there on the spot. When do you want to come back and what do I need to report back to you? So this is how professionally you sell in a big organization to someone where these are their concerns. Then I have this concept of respect the depth. And the first time I said this, I kind of heard a gasp in the room because we're all trained. Silos are bad. Silos are terrible. But you know what? The people who work in each of those silos have a career of expertise in what they do. And unless you start out with a position of respect for what they bring to the table, they're not going to listen to you. So what they have is the meat and the value that your organization provides. But they need you, just like you need them, because you're not an expert in what they do. They're not an expert in what you do either. And so that's where the partnership can really help. And be patient. Then you have to show them how. So that's having meetings with them on a regular basis. Show their successes. Give them a lesson of the month per newsletters, or post content on the internet about best practices. And we don't know this stuff innately. None of us know it, and they don't know it. So you can't blame them for not knowing it if you haven't been patient and persistent and repetitive and strategic nagging about what that's going to look like. And then help them work together. Give them projects. Do the personas. Have them work on the 75th anniversary or whatever it is, so that there's a thing they can do together and experience the value of working together. Because I find that in a lot of big organizations, folks don't work together because they don't know each other. So help them do that. And then motivate and recognize. So ultimately, at the end of the day, and I think this is equally true of UX people as it is of content strategists, is that we're coaches and therapists. Redefine success. So let them know the big green check mark doesn't come when you just put the thing up on the website. Did it work? And did it work doesn't mean did it get a lot of page views. It means did it produce the results that you intended it to produce in the first place. Again, just like no one knows they create content, no one is creating content just to create the views. The views have to do something. Get them to where they want so that their project is successful. And then educate and remind them. That's an agenda for a meeting that we had. Operationalize and socialize, so you're not just telling them what to do, but you're building into the CMS what they can and can't do. So you're setting the field limits, and you're requiring them to put related links if that's what you want to do. Give them options for creativity within limits, right? So it's the whole raising a toddler thing. You don't say, what do you want for breakfast? If Coca-Cola is not an option, you say milk or orange juice. So you give them options. If you want to have some cool jazzy thing on your site, it's not the guy walking across the bottom. It's things that we've blessed, solutions and options that you have that we're good with. And then after a while, you blame the policy. Hey, look, if it were up to me, I would let you have the blue blinking type, but the policy says otherwise. So if the policy is shopped and approved, then it becomes sort of law, whoever wrote it, even if it's you. And present solid rationales, report on progress. And ultimately, it's this. So instead of having an opposition where we're on opposite sides of the rink, we're working together for the satisfaction of our users. And that is it. So I think there's three levels. One level is, I do it for you. That's convenience. But it ultimately doesn't teach them anything. Empowerment is, I tell you what to do, you do it. And the ultimate level is that you're accountable for the end result. And that's it. Thanks so much. So what questions can I answer?
One of the best pieces of advice that I've gotten from you in the past is, like you said up here, to show the numbers. The discovery that I had one step beyond that was to let the shock and the pause in the silence at those numbers carry out. We had the CEO's All About the CEO page, and we looked at the analytics, and it had zero hits. Not even one. Like, his kid, his wife, not even one.
Him.
Right? Yeah, he hadn't even gone to see it. So we let him sit in the silence with that,
yeah,
and digest that. And
I have a client who has password-protected videos on their site, similar kind of topic, and it was password protected because it was very, you know, private, whatever. It got 4 views. So how much did the organization spend to get 4 views?
Hi, first, thank you so much for that talk. It was very illuminating. I work for an agency that then works with nonprofits and universities. And because you can't separate content from design we're more and more becoming involved with the content side of the work, the way that we are experts in design, we're also experts in writing for the web and choosing like how much of this information should be visual or language-based. And it's also extremely scary to get involved. It's like afraid to stir the hornet's nest, right?
Right.
Of your client's political situation that you don't really know about. So I guess I'd love to hear any advice you have for agencies that are working with a university, for example, on the content side and the governance and the strategy side.
So, I mean, I think that the activities of facilitating personas or engaging them together in a shared solution to a problem that you might see but they don't see, so getting them out of their department, out of their skin, and working on something together helps them develop something that's common, and the more that they've participated in it, the likelier they are to buy in, and even go so far as probably to champion that buy-in to their own group. So if it's not something that comes from on high, but something that feels more organic to them, the better.
Hillary, thanks so much. I was just curious, have you seen any trends with videos, and particularly in intranets? Are there people using them more or less, or are they longer or shorter? Have you seen any trends over the past couple of years?
Shorter and shorter and shorter. Yeah. At NAR, they had board meetings that were hours and hours long. And they recorded the entire board meeting because the board asked them to put them up on video. And nobody watched them all the way through. So I would say, yes, that's the trend, but you can tell. So more and more of the video tools out there for you to use measure where people drop off. So, you know, I don't think that it's a generic best practice, but you should look and see what the behavior is on the videos that you put up. And I also don't think that it's necessarily about the length of the video, but what's covered in it. And would it be worth just taking an excerpt or not putting it up at all or putting up the transcript? I mean, I think that there's lots of options. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
If you enjoyed this podcast from the 2015 IA Summit, subscribe and check out the full collection at library.iasummit.org and on iTunes. The 2015 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by the UIE All You Can Learn Library. The All You Can Learn Library will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to experts and UX topics. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.